Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. On this weekend show, we're going to be, again, focusing on the resource sector, which, boy oh boy, continues to move. We're seeing positive moves in a lot of different metals, precious metals leading the way, but base metals have been rebounding as well as the energy sector. We're going to start off with more of the metal sector in the first half of the show. Second half of the show, dive into the energy sector. Just to reiterate, a lot of daily editorials, a lot of company updates from this last week due to a lot of news that's come out of companies clearly getting more active and seeing a better market, albeit maybe not in hugely better share prices, but we have seen kind of rebounds across the board. And again, it's just a better market for resource investors. To kick off the show, we are chatting with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Matt, we got the pleasure of quickly bumping into you at the Beaver Creek Conference a couple weeks ago now. We all met with a lot of companies, and we all have different takeaways from these conferences. Before we share a little bit more of what we heard, although we've been sharing that throughout the last couple weeks, give us a little overview, the key themes that you took away from that conference in Beaver Creek.
Well, it's good to be joining you, Corey and Shad, and it was good seeing you in person. It's been a while. Look, it was a really interesting conference. I would say the conference was a bit of a tale of two halves. Earlier on, I got there Tuesday evening, so I really only experienced it on Wednesday, but I heard the same for Tuesday. It's a relatively somber mood. I wouldn't say it was despondent like we saw in 2023, but somber, which is a strange paradox with gold at all-time highs. But then we saw a major breakout in the gold price above 2,600 on the Wednesday, and that move continued throughout the week. So I felt a palpable change in sentiment just over the course of the final couple of days of the conference. So that was exciting to see. I was busy while I was there, able to catch up with 8 of our 18 holdings. So anytime you're able to catch up with 40-odd percent of one's portfolio in a single go is absolutely a conference that's worthwhile. It was interesting to hear that attendance, at least according to the conference organizers, was at record high. I didn't get that sense. It might have just been the subdued mood earlier on, but apparently there was quite a bit of foot traffic kind of throughout the course of the few days in Beaver Creek. And I guess a key takeaway, and this is definitely dovetails with the focus of the MJG portfolio, but there is significant talk about M&A, particularly within the junior royalty space. We've seen a good amount of deals over the past few years. I mean, the ones that come to mind most recently was Trident being absorbed by Deterra, ASX-listed Deterra. But other deals in the relatively recent past include Nova going into Metalla, the Mavericks Triple Flag merger, Nomad into Sandstorm. A couple years back, Altus being taken over by Elemental. And then before that, Gold Royalty going on its acquisition spree for Ely Gold, Abitibi Royalties, and Golden Valley. I think we see more of the same. There's a lot of talk going on between the CEOs. I think the junior royalty names, which until maybe a week ago had been largely forgotten. I mean, if you look at the share price of Elemental, which is one of our larger royalty positions in the portfolio, or an EMX, both names were down year to date just at the beginning of this month, which is in stark contrast to a gold price that's now up 30-odd percent a year to date, and a copper price that's up double digit. For both of those names, both gold and copper are quite relevant. We've seen a pretty sharp move in both of those, particularly Elemental. So I think some investors are returning to the junior space, but the valuation disconnects we're seeing between the smaller royalty players and the big boys, the Royal Golds, the Wheatons, the Francos of the world, are wider than I've seen in many years. And I think one big question is whether we see those, you know, senior tier one royalty players actually come downstream and do corporate M&A. They've entirely refrained from doing that so far. There's some skepticism whether they'll ever do that and come down and acquire one of these smaller names outright versus continuing to do asset by asset deals. But I guess going out on a limb, I actually do see at least one of these deals occurring in the next 6 months here. Probably the most likely name would be Origin, just due to their 1% NSR held over at the Silicon Merlin project in Nevada, owned by AngloGold Ashanti. I think it's possible if Origin decides to sell that royalty, that come downstream and take a very close look at that. And other names that have assets of scale that could be of interest to these biggest players include the EMXs of the world with their Timok project in Serbia and their Caserones royalty down in Chile. Elemental also has a royalty over Caserones. Gold Royalty has some, I would say, world-class, longer-dated royalties at the Odyssey mine at the Canadian Malartic. So these are the potential names where we could see movement, but Origin would probably be top of the list, where if we do see one of these smaller juniors taken out by the largest names, they're probably first in line.
Yeah, some interesting comments, Matt. We do have Fred from Elemental on and Dave from EMX on quite regularly. We've actually featured a lot of the royalty companies. We've had Patty on and Marco from Origin. And so we've covered some of those assets, and they are generational assets, both the copper and the gold. But it makes you think that there's still some apathy in the sector. When you look at the royalty companies, some of the margins some of these companies have are flirting with $1,500 to $2,000 an ounce gold, for example. And so it's just interesting that they haven't really screamed higher. You would think more analysts would be jumping on these royalty companies and saying, holy cow, look at this, in the same way that we haven't seen. I mean, the gold producers have been responding, and some of the majors like Agnico or some of the larger mid-tiers like Alamos have done well. But when you look at the GDX, Matt, it just hasn't even got above its 2020 peak, much less it's nowhere close to the 2011 peak. What do you think it's going to take to get more generalists looking at the gold producers, the silver producers, but also these royalty companies that have such fat margins right now?
Well, I think it's coming. And I think the clear answer to this is this move in gold that we've seen has been driven primarily by central bank buying. I think that's the key driver of this incredible gold price performance that we've seen over the past going on 12 or 15 months here. And I would argue that stems from the Biden administration's decision going all the way back into early 2022, cutting Russia off of the SWIFT banking system and really sending the shiver up the spines of other countries out there that may not be on the outs with the United States, but may not also be our closest allies, concerning if they step awry in the future, you know, whether a good chunk of their foreign currency reserves, you know, could be put at risk in such a scenario. So I think it made logical sense for the central banks to shift some of their exposure away from the U.S. dollar and to gold, which is the alternative currency of choice. So I think that's where the bulk of this move has come from. And I mean, if you look at outflows of the GDX, outflows in terms of the major gold, physical gold ETFs like the GLD, up until the past few weeks, we've not seen the Western world participate at all in these moves. So that to me is actually a very promising contrarian signal. And I think that's where we get this next kick higher in precious metal prices. My hope is that we consolidate here. We've come a long way in a short amount of time, and this is a wonderful gold price for any producer that's out there. But I think once we see the Western world start turning to gold and getting excited about precious metals, that's when you'll see those flows. Because of course, central banks themselves have no interest in buying mining shares, even at gold price levels such as these.
So Matt, regarding these smaller royalty companies, how do you go about analyzing them? Simply because, look, they do have big margins, but they don't generate that much revenue. Like, we're talking a couple million dollars a quarter for these companies. They don't need to spend much, which is nice. But again, if you're trying to put a multiple on their current revenue or earnings, it's not that big of a base to start from, but you project out some of the years, 2, 3, 4 years down the road, these companies should be generating even more revenue without having to do anything. So how do you go about analyzing these smaller royalty companies, which there are a lot of, and they all seem to make a few million dollars a quarter?
Well, I start with the people first and foremost, as I do for any of our investments. And I want to see teams with healthy skin in the game, a track record of staying disciplined, and obsessive focus on reducing G&A. And I think Elemental, the name I brought up earlier and a name that I've written about in the past probably 5 or 6 MJG letters at this point, it exemplifies that. They took over Alta Strategies a couple years back and have done a great job of paring down G&A. Also in that case, reducing royalty generation expenditures as well. But, you know, people come first and foremost. In terms of valuation, I mean, there are a couple ways to look at it. First is the price to cash flow. or price to revenue multiples that you reference. I prefer to look at it on an NAV basis and try to value each and every one of the key royalties on a case-by-case basis, and then couple that together in an overall valuation, and then see where the company's valuation is trading relative to what I view fair value for the full portfolio. And I would say royalty companies that are valued at above 1.2x NAV should be aggressive and be out there looking not to grow for growth's sake, but out quite aggressive looking for new opportunities to use their paper to grow their portfolio. Conversely, if you're somewhere in that, you know, 0.7 to 1.2 range, largely sitting tight, and if you're trading up below a 0.7x NAV multiple, the focus should be on either buying back shares or paying dividends. So I think that's a pretty easy formula for these management teams to pursue, just depending on where the market's valuing them at any given time.
Well, Matt, you brought up the theme of M&A from Beaver Creek, and there's a lot of buzz around that, but just specifically in the royalty space, we actually pound for pound have seen more consolidation and more business combinations in the royalty companies than we really have in the producers or the developers or the explorers. But a lot of people still make the same comment every time royalty companies come up. There's too many of them. There's too many choices. But some of them offer different strategies. So I would like to get your thoughts on this too. Are there too many companies, or do they give investors kind of different flavors? Because some are prospect generators, some buy baskets of royalties, some do one-off deals, some create royalties by lending money. There's different strategies that are at play here. Do you think there's too many companies, and should we just have four or five in the very end of this where they've all consolidated up into bigger companies, or is it healthy to have juniors and mid-tiers in the space?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think all things equal, the less vehicles, the better from an investor perspective. Because firstly, there's less competitive tension in terms of new deals and less groups bidding against each other. And secondly, there's fewer vehicles to attract inflows. So I think somewhat sensible M&A is always in the best interest of investors in the space. And I do think we see a consolidation push, as I mentioned earlier. I think a lot of these companies hanging out in the $200 or $300 million market cap range realize that they're either going to have to band together and try to form a royalty company that can get closer to that $1 billion market cap threshold and kind of take the next step as a company, or they'll get picked off one by one. So it'll be interesting to see if folks can put egos aside and agree on valuations where these mergers make sense. And we're also reaching a bit of a sweet spot here where it's really hard to agree to a deal when you're at a 52-week low. But we've seen a number of these names jump 10, 15, 20% off of their lows this year. And I think when you get into that 20 to 30% sweet spot off of the lows, that's when management teams are more willing to come to the table and make sensible deals. So whether it's names that we own in the MJG portfolio or peer companies that I'm just following along, I'd like to see more M&A. With that said, it's hard to imagine there ever being four to five names in the space, because if we do see a consolidation spree of that magnitude where we have seven or eight deals over the next 24 months and the space is really consolidated down, I do know of a few private royalty vehicles that would probably take that opportunity to come onto the scene and list publicly. So I don't think we're ever going to get down to that degree of concentration, but I still see deals ahead.
Hey, it makes sense there are so many royalty companies. It is a good business model, less capital intensive, and one where they do actually generate revenue, which is something for junior resource companies. Let's talk more M&A then. Another, let's call it mega deal in the sector, and that is Anglo Gold Ashanti going after Centamin. This company runs the Sukari open pit gold mine in Egypt. This is Egypt's largest gold mine. I think this is estimated at a little under 500,000 ounces of gold production per year. This is clearly a tier one asset. This is a $2.5 billion deal as well. Matt, this just speaks to the fact that there is M&A going on in the sector, and it's mega deals. What do you think of this deal?
Well, a number of thoughts. I mean, I guess to your final point there, this continues a trend of pretty remarkable amount of deal making just in the past 8 weeks, a period of the year which is generally pretty slow from an M&A perspective. And we've touched on some of these deals in recent calls, but just going back to the Filo deal, that was less than 8 weeks ago in late July. $4.1 billion there. The Osisko mining deals following on the heels of Filo. Goldfields coming in, a $2.1 billion takeout. More recently, we had the Gatos Silver First Majestic tie-up. There's another $1.3 billion CAD One deal that people maybe have overlooked, Codelco came in and bought Enami's free carry 10% stake in Teck's QB mine down in Chile. That's another 700 million CAD. And then just most recently, the Monday before the Beaver Creek conference, we had the Anglo Gold and Sentiment announcement, $3.4 billion. We're talking $11.5 billion Canadian in terms of total M&A value in an eight-week period. I think that's pretty remarkable. And there are more discussions ongoing, including deals that were just hatched or in the process of being hatched at the Beaver Creek conference itself. Of course, these deals don't come together overnight. So in terms of deals that came together at the conference, there's going to be a 4, 5, 6 month lag most likely before they're ultimately announced. So I think the M&A landscape remains particularly busy. In terms of the Anglo Gold Sentiment deal specifically, I am a big fan of the Sukari asset. I was able to visit it back in early 2023. As you mentioned, I mean, it is a true tier one mine. They're looking to get it to 500,000 ounces per annum production levels by mid-2025. And there's a 10-year life on that, if not 15-year life. And I think a key question is whether now AngloGold going forward is going to have success with regional exploration to turn this from a 10 to 15-year mine into something that could last multiple decades. I think that's possible. And I've heard through the grapevine that they're honing in on some potential regional targets that are still well within trucking distance of Sukari. So I think that probably has informed AngloGold's decision as well. Tier one mine for AngloGold. Additionally, their share price had run 60% year to date up until the day that the deal was announced relative to Sentiment's 30% move year to date. So they're using their relative outperformance from a share price perspective to justify this deal. So it makes sense on those two levels. I would say, though, a little bit of a surprise for two reasons. The first is that AngloGold's center of gravity has seemed to move away from Africa. Just last year, they announced that they were relocating their headquarters, their global headquarters, from Johannesburg to Denver, presumably showing a shift in the company's focus to their flagship development project, Silicon, the expanded Silicon project in Nevada. And then additionally, we have no horse in this race. We're not AngloGold shareholders, nor are we Sentiment shareholders. But if I were an AngloGold shareholder, I view the expanded Silicon project as truly a crown jewel asset, a generational mine, easily on its way to 20 million ounces. That's a foregone conclusion. And 30 million is within the realm of possibility if one wants to arm wave. It's a remarkable mine, and we could see up to 1 million ounces per annum of production there by early next decade. So I'm a big bull on the expanded Silicon project. And by doing this deal, AngloGold has diluted its shareholders' exposure to expanded Silicon by roughly 17%. By issuing these shares to Sentiment. So that was a little bit of a head scratcher for me as well. But broader strokes, it's good to see the M&A continue. And this deal just adds to the massive tally that we've just seen over the past couple months here.
Well, Matt, just to that point about the massive tally, I think a lot of these deals, when they're the big companies buying large companies and they're billion-dollar plus transactions, so $2 billion, $3 billion, $4 billion, they do make the news and they are great for the sector. But they don't really get a lot of that money circulating down into the juniors. I guess the exception would be the Filo one is something where people that were early investors liked the exploration and development side. And so when BHP and Lundin Mining took them out, that does get money circulating. The Osisko Mining one is probably the one that rang the most in the sector as far as getting the animal spirits going, because you had Goldfields taking over a development project with Osisko Mining. Don't we need to see more of those kind of deals, like high premium on development stage assets, to really get the circulation of money going and really the excitement about who could be next?
Yeah, I think you make a fair point. It's unrealistic to expect that these large sums are going to suddenly trickle down into one's favorite expiration stage junior. But I think there will be some of that. But, you know, the prime immediate term beneficiaries are these large late stage development projects. And we've seen the Artemis Golds of the world rally and the Skeena Golds of the world rally on the back of these news. That's the more obvious place for the money to go in the immediate term. But I do think we do see the trickle down. And then another point that's worth noting would be there is a distinction between the all cash and all share deals. So what gets me particularly excited about the Filo deal and the Osisko Mining deal in particular are that they're either entirely in cash or largely in cash. And between those two deals, we have $4.9 billion in cash trading hands. And those deals will close. The Osisko deal later this year. Filo is projected early next year. So we're talking $4.9 billion in cash trading hands within the next 4 months.
So, Matt, when you say you think that money will filter down, the M&A will filter down into some of the other companies, are you talking juniors or are we still talking these assets that are defined? Because it just seems like there are so many multi-million ounce assets all around the world that these majors can still move on rather than going into the earlier stage, earlier resource companies.
Right. Well, I'm seeing a bit of a move in our names just over the past 4 or 5 days. So I'm not sure if the tide has turned and we've reached an inflection point in here, but there's promising activity even amongst the smaller junior names. As you guys well know, we're very much skewed to the junior side of the spectrum with a median market cap within the MJG portfolio of roughly 40 million Canadian at this point in time. And it has been frustrating watching metal prices perform very well this year. Money start to trickle down into the largest of producers, but for it to largely remain elusive for some of the smaller names in the market. We're seeing some movement now. Whether this is just a blip or a start of a more sustained move remains to be seen. I'm in the camp that this will be a sustained move as long as the broader markets remain largely buoyant as we've seen them been. We've seen the TSXV move comfortably above its 200-day simple moving average and 200-day exponential moving average. And I've seen anecdotally within our portfolio some really strong moves amongst our sub 100 million market cap names. So let's see if it continues. But I mean, this is the way a proper bull market is supposed to transpire. If you look back to the flashes in the pan we had in 2016 and the 6 or 8 months after the COVID crash in 2020, we had the gold price move, the seniors move, and the juniors move really in tandem. And those moves ended up not turning out to be particularly long lasting. So if you want to look at this from a glass half full perspective, this is how a proper sustained move is supposed to work, with the metal prices moving first, and then the larger producers finding their footing. And then eventually, as people's animal spirits are whetted, people coming further downstream to the development, then earlier stage development, and then into the expiration stage name. So I think we may begin to see that happening right now.
Yeah, fair point, Matt. It is a healthier bull market sign to see that we're not in a mania phase and that things are happening in the sequence they normally do in longer runs. So hopefully there's some legs to this. You mentioned some things starting to move, though, and I think we should touch on another sector in the resource space that has been moving, and that's the uranium sector. And the uranium equities have had a rough go of it since May. They had a nice pop to start the year. They had another pop kind of in the early or late spring. But then there was a couple months of pain, and just in September, things have turned around for the uranium equities and also for the fundamentals in the nuclear power sector. So I'd love to get your thoughts on the recent bounce we saw in September for the uranium stocks.
It's interesting. I don't know if we've ever discussed uranium in our interviews. And I should caveat this by saying we have minimal exposure within the MJG fund to uranium at the moment. We own a small position in a prospect generator that has a couple active partnerships in the Athabasca Basin and also some 100% owned ground that they hopefully will be able to partner out here in the near future. But absent that, we've had no significant uranium exposure since mid-2020. We did find tremendous success with Global Atomic. It was one of the two names that we purchased in the immediate aftermath of the COVID crash in early 2020. And we were able to get first shares that are on 40 cents per share and then average up in a private placement where I believe it was at 65 cents per share. That company ran up as high as $5 in the 2 year period after in which we owned it. So that treated us very well, but decided to exit in mid-2022 for valuation reasons. I think it's a wonderful deposit and I wish them the best of luck in developing it. But that was in hindsight a pretty fortuitous exit point before things got rough in Niger, to say the least, let alone the Sahel more generally in West Africa. But that experience kind of informed my view that an excellent time to buy uranium equities are on the backs of major liquidity events. And I've been waiting for another such liquidity event to occur, and it has not yet. So as of now, I feel we're quite light on uranium. The reason I like uranium on the back of liquidity events, a couple reasons. The first is that it's a pretty sexy space. There's a lot of, you know, speculative premiums built into some of these names, retail and generalist excitement. In terms of my non-resource investor friends, uranium is really the only metal that they have any interest in at the moment. That kind of shifted from lithium a couple years back. But there's quite a few eyeballs on these names. So when you go into a sell-off period, oftentimes you'll see the declines more pronounced than in other metals. And then secondly, uranium, aside from gold, I really can't think of a metal that is less correlated to near and medium term global GDP growth, just because once a reactor is built and in operation, it will be continued to be fed uranium for the life of that reactor, full stop. So even in periods of severe economic slowdowns, you're not seeing, you know, nuclear reactors turned off at all. So that gives me some confidence when we go into these scary risk off environments to bite the bullet and look at uranium. You do note, however, that we have seen pretty sharp sell-off in the uranium equities since the spring. And that divergence has caught my attention, and especially between uranium equities, which even after this bounce that you've noted in September are still down year to date, and the spot price of uranium, which is up double digits year to date. So I think this has presented an interesting entry point, even though we aren't in a crisis-like scenario that I look for. And so I have sharpened my pencils on a couple uranium names. There's one in particular that I've identified and I'm excited about. However, haven't pulled the trigger as the MJG fund is fully deployed at the moment with a minimal cash position. So that could change if we have a liquidity event within the existing MJG portfolio and or additional inflows into the fund. But as of now, there's one name I've identified, but we've not yet pulled the trigger on uranium. And then I just end by saying more broadly, I love early stage mineral exploration, and you can look at the portfolio construction of the MJG fund to verify that. However, I don't love it as it pertains to uranium. I would argue there are just so many pounds that have already been discovered that are advancing through the development life cycle, in addition to many brownfield restart opportunities that I think we see come online in the coming few years. So I think the bar for a greenfield uranium discovery is just so high, it's not an attractive risk-reward proposition from my perspective. So my bias is towards those late-stage development or brownfield restart opportunities. I guess you could throw production stage names into that mix as well. Or there's nothing wrong with simply buying Sput or Yellow Cake and just holding physical pounds. In terms of how to play uranium more generally, that's how I think about it.
So what about the underlying factors driving this new uranium bull market, or at least the bull market that we saw over the last year and a bit, where uranium went higher, these stocks went higher? We saw a lot of new uranium stocks come into the market. Recently had that Microsoft and Constellation deal, restarted Three Mile Island. What are some of the real drivers behind this market that makes you think it's more sustainable?
Well, I think it's real. Yeah, I'm a real bull on nuclear power over the next 20 to 25 years. But it's a long-term, this is going to be a long-term process, and there's going to be many market panics in between now and then. I think the news items that have gotten attention just in the past really few days would be the Constellation Energy deal with Microsoft that made headlines across mainstream press, with Constellation restarting one of the reactors at Three Mile Island, the infamous Three Mile Island, in order to supply Microsoft's data farms. AI and nuclear have been linked from an investment thematic, and I think that more and more folks are going to recognize that going forward. And then just on Monday, we had, you know, a whole bunch of Wall Street banks get together and say in unison that they want to support the nuclear transition and help the world, you know, triple its nuclear power output by 2050. So these are all positive headline news items. Doesn't necessarily mean that one should go out and buy a basket of juniors indiscriminately hand over fist. I think if you aren't interested in paying attention to the nuances of each and every one of your uranium investments, it's simpler to just buy the physical metal and hang on from there. But just as I do with any of our investments, I really look at them on a case-by-case basis. And the company has to make sense on a fundamental level, assuming flat metal prices for the foreseeable future. And so I take that same approach to the uranium space, even understanding that there's probably room to run over the coming few years here from a metal price perspective, but I'm just not an optionality investor. So each of our names need to make sense at spot or lower uranium for me to get excited.
Well, Matt, do you ever look at some of the complete mismatches in supply demand that are coming up from the mining side to the supply side? Because most of the supply has been coming out of Kazakhstan. They've had all kinds of problems from Kazatomprom getting acid. There's new tax regimes there that's squeezing any future production. Cameco is the only Canadian producer right now. Orano, the French producer, had all kinds of problems in Niger, and they're not really coming to the table. That leaves a peppering of a half dozen U.S. companies that do in-situ mining that are going to bring on some pounds, but not nearly enough to feed all the reactor builds, the AI data center narrative, or just the electricity that's needed in the developing world. I think a lot of people are starting to realize there's not really any new supply that's of significance coming on for maybe 3 to 5 years. Some of the big development projects are nowhere close to coming online. So does that create maybe an unrealized opportunity, even in the development stage or brownfield sites you were talking about, to still have the big run that maybe the big run hasn't happened yet?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the term unrealized opportunity, and that's maybe where I push back. I mean, I think, yes, it's likely that this theme will continue to permeate into the broader investment community as folks realize what's happening. But there are already a lot of eyeballs on uranium and in uranium equities. So I think that's the first point I'd make. And then we are seeing quite a few new mines or restarts come online, whether it's Paladin's Langer Heinrich, Encore, or UEC in the United States, Boss Energy in Australia. So we're seeing a bit of a supply response. Whether it's going to be able to meet the demands over the next 3 to 5 years, I think that remains to be seen. But, you know, one has to note that there has been a price reaction, both in the the prices of the equities, of course, but also in the underlying price of uranium, which is up over 4x in a 6 to 7 year period here. So we're not early in the move, but I also wouldn't by any means say that we're in the later stages either. From my perspective, it's more about picking our spots and finding the right vehicle for that exposure. But look, I mean, I'm a believer in nuclear and uranium, as I said, but I also do my best to resist FOMO. And I think there are plenty of other avenues for one to make money within the natural resource investment sphere, even without exposure to uranium.
Okay. Matt, very interesting. It's always a pleasure chatting with you. And it was great seeing you at the conference. We get to see you there. Seems like every year. And sometimes when you come to Vancouver, we get to meet up. It's always a pleasure to hear what kind of stocks you're looking at. And yeah, you're right. It has been encouraging to see some of these juniors start to show some life. But boy, oh boy, we still know how big that disconnect is. But look, there's a lot of M&A happening. There's the majors moving. It does seem very much like a bull market where the money could filter down to the juniors. But right now, there's still a lot of opportunities broadly in the metals and resource sector for investors to be making money. Matt Geiger, again, managing partner at MJG Capital. Click that link in the show notes to visit the MJG Capital website. Learn more about Matt's fund. Matt, thank you for your time on this weekend show. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.